From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
These are businesses. These Catholic agencies, St. Dominic's, St. Vincent's, Little Flowers. These children are worth approximately $70,000 a year.
A struggle for justice. Today, the story of one family's fight to get their children back from the foster care system. And then, singer Michael Franti.
Good morning, world. Welcome to Democracy Now! And power to the peaceful.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The founder of one of the nation's largest cable companies and two of his sons were arrested Wednesday on charges they looted the company of more than $1 billion. The founder and former chief executive of Adelphia, John Regas, and two of his sons were taken into custody by federal agents at 6 a.m. yesterday at their Manhattan apartment. Prosecutors contend the former executives improperly used company money for everything from personal loans to buy stock to building a $13 million golf course to shuttling family members back and forth on a corporate jet from a safari vacation in Africa. Adelphia filed for bankruptcy protection last month. A federal magistrate freed them on $10 million bail. Their lawyer hinted the public arrest may have been politically motivated as part of Washington's effort to demonstrate its prosecution of corporate fraud. AOL Time Warner disclosed Wednesday the Securities and Exchange Commission has launched a probe into its accounting practices. House and Senate leaders announced Wednesday they have agreed on a series of corporate reforms, including new regulations of businesses and their auditors, stiffer penalties for those who commit financial fraud, and new protections for whistleblowers. By the end of the day, stocks registered one of their biggest one-day gains ever after four straight days of heavy losses. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer told reporters President Bush still wants workers to divert some of their Social Security payroll taxes into the stock market, despite the dramatic drops Wall Street has suffered in recent months. The House voted overwhelmingly last night to expel Congressman James Traficant. He's an Ohio Democrat who was convicted in April on 10 counts of bribery, racketeering, and corruption. It's only the second time since World War II that a House member was expelled from Congress. The Washington Times is reporting the State Department has warned American Foreign Service officers and employees to stop sending emails ridiculing members of Congress. The order comes after the publication of two emails. In one, two U.S. diplomats called Congressman Benjamin Gilman brainless. Gilman is a New York Republican and a former chair of the House International Relations Committee. In the second case, U.S. Consul General in Rome, Charles Keel, sent an email calling Congressmember Dan Burton a witch hunter in the tradition of former Senator Joseph McCarthy. Dan Burton is an Indiana Republican and chair of the House Government Reform Committee. Diplomat Columbia Burroughs responded with an email saying a neo-Nazi would probably take over the State Department division responsible for issuing visas. 10 congressmen sent a letter yesterday to Secretary of State General Colin Powell demanding that he fire Keel and Burroughs. The State Department on Wednesday joined the White House in criticizing a deadly Israeli missile strike in Gaza City, but refused to answer questions on whether the attack violated the Arms Control Export Act, which regulates arms sales abroad. On Tuesday, Israeli forces used a U.S.-made F-16 fighter jet to drop a one-ton bomb into a densely packed neighborhood in Gaza City, killing a Hamas leader and 15 civilians, including 10 children. According to the Agence France-Presse, spokesperson Richard Boucher told reporters the law, quote, requires us to do a report if we believe arms aren't being used for legitimate self-defense or internal security. And he admitted that the State Department has not done a report on Israel. The New York Times headlined the same story, State Department raises concerns about Israel's use of U.S.-made arms. The New York Times version of the story comes the same day that the newspaper is reporting on its front page that Secretary of State General Colin Powell may not last through President Bush's term due to a series of internal policy differences and defeats. The London Guardian is reporting the European Union will announce soon that it will fill the gap left by the U.S. decision to withdraw $34 million in aid to the UN's Family Planning Organization. A coalition of British charities is launching an emergency appeal today to raise money for 14 million people facing starvation in southern Africa. And the United States failed to muster enough support yesterday to block a UN vote on a plan meant to help enforce an anti-torture agreement. The plan, which calls for independent visits to prisons, was passed 35-8 with 10 abstentions in the UN Economic and Social Council, known as ECOSOC. Human rights groups and diplomats said the plan was essential to ending torture around the world, but the United States said parts of it were incompatible with the U.S. Constitution. Privately, U.S. diplomats said allowing outside observers into state prisons would infringe on states' rights. Among the U.S. concerns was also language that could allow for international and independent visits to U.S. prisons and to people being held by the U.S. military at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba.
Jenny's home life when stabilized at the age of 15, learned to drink and drive. No one ever could seem to empathize, making babies in the backseat on tranquilizers. Papa never was much of Rolling Stones, he just liked to sit and drink alone. Mama always tried to do the best she could, she would work all day and come home to cook. But we all vain, we all strange, we all stained, we all love to just complain. But nobody wants to seem to get along, you see. We got shame, we got pain, we got blame, we all little bit insane. So that's why I sing the song, you know, because everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Even our worst enemies, Lord, they deserve music, music. And even the quiet ones in our family, they deserve music.
Everyone deserves music, Michael Franti, in our Firehouse studio. And we'll be hearing him sing and also talk to him later in the program. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country.
So you've been staying up late nights.
Well, yes, a couple of nights this week. I was trying to catch the hearings that were being broadcast on C-SPAN of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which was reviewing the role of the major banks. This is a continuing Enron investigation, reviewing the role of the major banks, especially Citibank and Chase, in the Enron scandal. And I have to tell you, I was amazed. The corporate media never ceases to amaze me that a few of the television networks were carrying these hearings, but C-SPAN was, because it was an amazing demonstration of the depth to which the biggest banks in this country were involved together with Enron in many of the schemes to defraud investors and to make off with billions of dollars. And you know the University of California Pension Fund filed suit on behalf of many of the pension funds and investors in Enron some months ago, and at the time Chase and Citicorp called it a creative lawsuit. But it turns out that much of what the University of California funds is alleging is true. And for instance, that Chase was so involved. There was one of these offshore companies called Mahonia, which Enron created in the Channel Islands to basically engage in fictitious trades with fictitious energy trades with another company that Enron formed in the Channel Islands. And a federal judge recently ruled in one of the lawsuits stemming from this that the money that Chase put into this Mahonia was just nothing more than disguised loans that were being hidden from shareholders and from the public to boost up falsely boost up Enron's revenues. And also that the turns out that many of the chief executives at Merrill Lynch, at Citicorp, and at Chase were also given the opportunity to invest personally in a lot of the same companies that they were lending money to in order to enrich themselves personally as well as the banks with their fees. So it's really a sordid tale of the complicity and involvement of some of the major banks in this country in the Enron Ponzi scheme.
Hmm. Well, as we hear more about this and about the free fall now of stocks, at least until yesterday, in both Citigroup and Chase. I'm so used to calling it Chase Manhattan, but J.P. Morgan Chase. And soon,
and Travelers, Citicorp, Solomon Smith, Barney. Right.
Soon it'll all be one big name, one big happy family. But we're going to talk about another kind of family, about the family that a lot of people know, just the families that try to get by in this country. And we're going to look at a whole different issue, and it has to do with adoption and foster care. This week, President Bush held a nationally televised press conference on Tuesday where he proudly announced a new adoption campaign urging American families to adopt children in foster care. He unveiled the first ever national website on adoption, www.usadoptkids.org, and announced a series of PSAs featuring Laura Bush and actor Bruce Willis, who was with him as he made this announcement. As the Associated Press reported, the adoption event in the White House's Grand East Room allowed Bush to appeal to his voter base of Christian conservatives by promoting an alternative to abortion and to burnish his credentials as a compassionate conservative by extending a government hand to at-risk children.
Adoptive parents have a special calling, and you deserve our gratitude. There are many children in America, toddlers, teens, brothers and sisters, who need to stay together. And children from every background. They urgently need love and permanent homes. Finding that home may determine a more hopeful course for their entire life. Right now, there are about 130,000 children in our nation's foster care system waiting to be adopted. 130,000 precious lives hoping to find a permanent home. Good foster care is essential, yet children hunger for the stability of a permanent home. And every child deserves to be a part of a permanent and loving family. That's our hope.
President Bush at a news conference on Tuesday. Speeding up adoptions may sound on the surface like a good idea, but today we're going to go below the surface and we're going to look at foster care and what it means when biological parental rights are severed. In his famous book, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois once wrote, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line." Today we're going to talk about one of those color line stories, one of those major dividing lines. Here in New York, there's a department, an agency called the Administration of Children's Services. The vast majority of white people don't even know the acronym ACS, but a good number of African Americans and Latinos know it too well and fear it. Today we're going to tell you one story. It's the story of the Pena family in the Bronx. Lucy and Jose, 10 years ago, had a son and then a daughter. Lucy tested positive for drugs in the hospital when she gave birth to her daughter, Nancy, and ACS took both her kids away, Joseph and Nancy. They were placed in St. Dominic's home in the Bronx to await foster care and adoption. Lucy and Jose, the parents, immediately stopped doing drugs. They worked to rehabilitate their lives so that they could get their kids back. A few years later, Lucy gave birth to Stacy, and she was allowed to keep her. Lucy and Jose have been clean for 9 years now, but ACS will not return their children to them, even though Joseph has never been adopted. Now Stacy, who's 6 years old, has sued for her birthright. She is sued in federal court, and this is unprecedented, for the right to see her biological brother and sister. In an explosive event that happened about a year ago in court when this lawsuit went forward, the parents, Lucy and Jose Pena, learned that, well, they had thought that both of their kids were adopted in one home. Their daughter, Nancy, was, But in court, they said, in a closed court, they were told that both St. Dominic's, which was responsible for their children, and ACS, the Department of Children's Services, did not know where Joseph was, that he had not been adopted. He had gone back into foster care, and despite their repeated pleas to be able to take their son back, they now did not know where he was, and he was somewhere in the system. But we'll let them tell their story in a documentary that has just been made about them. It's called A Struggle for Justice. It's produced and narrated by Woody Henderson, who will join us after the segment that we play in our studio. This is Lucy and Jose Pena's story.
In many ways, they seem like the all-American family. However, her parents, Jose and Lucy Pena, have to bear a cross that's too heavy for many of us to carry. You see, Lucy and Jose have two other children. Stacy's older brother and sister, Joseph and Nancy, were placed into foster care 3 years before Stacy's birth. Her parents had fallen prey to the drug epidemic of the early 90s. Having their children taken from them was both devastating and a rude awakening. However, they understood why their children had been removed.
We needed a wake-up call. Our lives were spiraling downhill. I had debts in my family. I could give you every excuse.
Lucy Pena.
Some people don't need an excuse to use, but I've had problems that led to the use. But we weren't so severely that deep in the problem that a little intervention couldn't have helped us and got us back on the road again. After the birth of my second child, it was like, you have cocaine in your system. My daughter did not. I came in the hospital positive of cocaine. I remained in there for 3 days before giving birth. I almost ended up taking her home when a social worker came in and told me that I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm calling Child Protective Services. I mean, I was so grateful that her toxicology report was clean. To me, that was a sign, get it together. So I was ready to go for help, do anything. But they still said, because you came in positive, we got to report it. Right away, my baby was held. I never even got to take her home out of the hospital. Joseph, who was 18 months old at the time, remained with us. 3 days afterwards, they took him out of the home with two police officers. When they came, there was no drug use. We were getting ready to put my son to bed. He was clean, bathed, and they said, we are here to take him. We cooperated without a struggle, and we've been struggling ever since.
They quickly changed their lifestyle, stopped using drugs, and began following all court-ordered necessary steps to get their children returned. It was during this period that Lucy became pregnant with Stacy.
They were aware of this, of their new sibling. They were aware that I was having a baby girl. I shared in the pregnancy with them. Now, I'm not sure how much memory they have of Stacy, even though we talked very much about the pregnancy to the children, because our plan was to get them home.
But these plans have yet to be realized as Stacy grows up an only child, but not in her mind. In her mind, Nancy and Joseph are a tangible part of her life, and in some ways, her reason for living.
I like to make pictures, and especially pictures of Nancy and Joseph.
Who's Nancy and Joseph?
My brother and sister.
I knew that. You miss them? You want to see them?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So how does your mom and dad feel about it? Do you ever talk about them?
Well, sometimes me and my mom talk about it, and sometimes my dad. And we all really miss my brother and sister. Yeah. One time I dreamt that me and them were in the roller coaster, and we were playing. And then we got home, and then Nancy said, hey, Stacy looks just like me. And then Joseph says, yes, of course, because we're in the family. And Nancy said, oh, yeah. And then we had a lot of time at home. And then we were together again.
Do you think you'll ever get a chance to meet them?
Well, in God's will, I hope yes. Mm-hmm.
It was obvious that Stacy had already bonded with her brother and sister, even though she had never met them in the flesh. Her parents, who had never broken their bond, continued to search for ways to reunify their family. St. Dominic's, the foster care agency that had legal possession of Nancy and Joseph, showed little desire to expeditiously reunite this family while leading them through a maze of deceit and deception.
All St. Dominic's told us was that if we got ourselves clean, we could get our kids back. They were threatening to free them up for adoption.
Terminate your rights.
Terminate our rights. So we knew we had to move fast because it didn't look like anything was working in our favor. We went out and sought the help that was needed to get ourselves clean, to get documentation that we were getting clean, and we were getting support. And it was all outside and away from the administration. Because anything they offered us turned out to be, in my book, bogus. Waiting list, drug rehab centers that you needed Medicaid to get in, you needed some type of insurance. I was turned away. Yet they said I wasn't complying. I mean, we received so many roadblocks that Jose and I decided we need to knock on some doors away from them.
The Peñas continued knocking on countless doors, looking for anyone who could help them prove that not only were they ready, but worthy of being reunited with their children. Behind one of these doors, they found Imani Taylor.
I met Jose and Lucy approximately 4 or 5 years ago. And when they met with me for the first time, they, I guess, had reached the end of the road, in a sense. It was pretty overwhelming with all the information that they had, you know. They were constantly walking around with papers. They had case notes from the judge. They had copies of just about everything. They had letters that they had written to community liaisons and, you know, and the responses back from those liaisons and, you know, different offices. And it just seemed like they were constantly knocking at a door. The time that they were supposed to have completed things, they did everything in a timely manner. It wasn't last minute anything. But nonetheless, they were without two children.
Unfortunately, time had run out for the Peñas as their parental rights were terminated. Their visitations were discontinued and all contact with Nancy and Joseph was severed. They were left perplexed as to how the law and the courts could allow this to happen, when in all actuality, the law does not always operate in the best interest of the child. State Assemblyman Roger L. Green, chairman of the New York State Standing Committee on Children and Families, explains one such law.
The Adoption and Safe Families Act accelerated the timeline for what they call permanency planning. What they really mean is that children should be moved towards adoption and also, in some cases, cutting the ties between those children and their biological parents. And so these numbers are clearly a reflection of this Adoption and Safe Family Act, which was mandated by the federal government. Here in New York State, the law was modified to some extent, but in many other cases, the law is still, I think, somewhat draconian, particularly as relates to parents that may have suffered from substance abuse. The treatment process for substance abuse necessitates in many ways that there will be some relapses, you know. And in acknowledging that, it would take more time for many parents to heal up from addiction, problems of addiction, than what the law allows. And so what we're seeing is that particularly many of the parents who originally suffered from some forms of addiction dating back to the mid-'80s, during the height of the crack epidemic, as an example. Many of those parents are now no longer addicted, but as a result of the law, they have lost their children.
The Peñas did not take this sitting down. They took to the streets, protesting whenever and wherever they could get their voices heard. Protest after protest, rally after rally. They were out for justice. Lucy, Joseph, and even little Stacy took part in organizing and staging countless demonstrations with one goal in mind, to be reunited with Nancy and Joseph.
A struggle for justice, and we'll come back to this documentary in a minute. Afterwards, we'll speak with Michael Franti.
When I look at the world, it fills me with sorrow.
It fills me with sorrow.
Little children today.
Children today.
Really gonna suffer tomorrow. What a shame.
What a shame.
Such a bad way to live.
Such a bad way to live.
Oh, who is to blame?
Who is to blame?
We can't stop living.
We can't stop living.
Live.
Live
for life.
But let me live, everybody.
Live life for the children.
Live life for the children.
You're listening to Democracy Now! That's Marvin Gaye, Save the Children, as we go back to A Struggle for Justice.
If you look at the system, It's a warehousing system.
Attorney,
they're
Imani
stripping our
Taylor
children from their natural parents, and they're throwing them into a home that has been certified by the foster care agency. But if you look at it, it's strictly a numbers game. These are businesses. These Catholic agencies, St. Dominic's, St. Vincent's, Little Flowers. These children are worth approximately $70,000 a year, dollars and cents. Every 100 children, you do the math, every 100 children in a St. Dominic's or a Little Flowers or a St. Vincent, you do the math.
In many cases, it benefits institutions who are not linked to our community.
State Assemblyman Roger Green of New York.
They make money from providing services and finding homes for children who have been, according to the courts, found to be neglected or abused.
Approximately one-fifth of children in foster care are in congregate care at a cost of about $54,000 a year. The remaining children in foster family homes at a cost of about $15,000 per year. ACS has an annual budget of $2.3 billion. This is Lucy Pena.
We had to stay straight and sane for our newborn, our baby coming. And that's exactly what we did. We lived in an open book life, because we wanted anyone and everyone to reference how we were raising her, how we were loving her, how we were nurturing her. We tried to get any and everyone involved so they could see that this is how much it meant to us, that rehabilitation is possible. Not in every case, not in every statement, once an addict, always an addict. We're living proof that there's a second chance at life and that we can have a life, a new life. I mean, my God, here are laws protecting criminals, giving them a second chance in the street after doing their time. They've done their time, let them come out and live. We're living a life sentence.
This is a case which should be, you know, highlighted as an example of best practices where, in fact, the mother and father in spite of the problems that they've had in the past, clearly have worked diligently to improve their lives and improve their conditions, to remove the scourge of drugs, you know, from their lives and their families, which may have hurt the family sometime in the past. But it's pretty clear that they've gone through a redemptive process, and at this point in time, probably be stronger than any other parents that are out here, by virtue of the fact that they've learned lessons in life that could be very instructive to these children, and they really now serve as some of the best role models that you could promote.
If they were such bad parents that warranted the
Attorney
terminating
Imani
of
Taylor.
Their parental rights, that Joseph is taken away, that Nancy is taken away, what logical sense does it make that Stacy remains with these bad people, but she turns out to be the wonderful child that she is? That's part of the remarkable inconsistency of the family court system, ACS, and these foster care agencies.
What baffles me is that I don't understand how parents can be good enough to take care of this child and not good enough to take care of the other ones. And that baffles me. Somebody would have to explain to me who made that decision and why.
I would appreciate a rematch on their idea of what is fit and unfit. Obviously, they left a child in our care to practice with. Mm-hmm. And why don't they come and see the good work we've done?
Why don't they come to investigate? Why? We don't have nothing to hide. Come. I invited them, set a file return receipt.
Jose Pena.
Why you don't come to investigate us to see? Just don't even bother. Don't worry about us, the parents. Come and check. Ha! Do the job, ACS.
Yes.
Do your job and do the right thing.
You said you were going to take the children, so why will you check on us, huh?
Stacy.
Stacy, do you have a message for Joseph and Nancy?
Yes. Nancy and Joseph, please come home because I really miss you. And God's will, I really love you in my heart.
Stacy Pena. Part of the documentary A Struggle for Justice. In the part of the film we didn't show you, it talked about how the court had denied Lucy and Jose Pena's request to get their children back, Nancy and Joseph. Nancy, their middle daughter, was adopted. They thought Joseph was adopted with her and said that they could live with that knowing that they were together, but only learned in this unprecedented lawsuit of Stacy's, the six-year-old, who was suing for her birthright to see her sister and brother, only learned in court last year that, in fact, Nancy was adopted by the family, but Joseph was given back into the system and that he remains in foster care. And they say that it was at that court, April 2001, that both the home that was supposed to be responsible for him, St. Dominic's, and ACS, the Administration of Children's Service in New York, said they didn't know where he was. At this point, the lawsuit is in federal court, and the Peñas continue to fight for their family. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by the filmmaker, Woody Henderson, who did A Struggle for Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And we're also joined by Hank Ornstein, who's the director of the Child Welfare Project and a lawyer with the New York City Public Advocates Office. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, welcome. Thank you. And just professionally, I'm a social worker, so not an attorney.
Congratulations. So is my mom.
All right.
Juan.
Well, you know, one of the amazing things in knowing some of the history of ACS, and of course it used to be called BCW, right? People used to think of it as BCW rather than ACS. But there were all of these allegations during the period of Mayor Giuliani's tenure that there was a big shakeup and reform, and Nicholas Scarpetta was brought in, a former prosecutor, to run the agency. And a lot of the reports have said that there was a big reform and the situation is better. But in many ways, it seems to me that what's happened is very similar, the same kind of prosecutorial punishment syndrome of that in the regular criminal justice system now has become a part of the child welfare system. I don't know what you either one of you think about that, or have you assessed these so-called reforms?
It's absolutely true. First of all, the family court is to deal with social issues, with family issues. It's not a criminal court. So to put a prosecutor to oversee that agency, 11 of the last 13 judges that Giuliani appointed were former prosecutors. The general counsel is a former prosecutor. So when many of the families are coming, and 98% of the children that have gone through that system are African American Latino. So many of these judges look at these people from the beginning as criminal and have been told that we're going to keep you from becoming a criminal like the rest, which is a form of profiling. It's a very serious issue because it negatively impacts communities of color. Less than 1% of the children are white. If the same thing was happening to white communities that's happening to black and Latino communities, there would be an outrage that would shake the very foundation of this city, this state, and country.
You know, we're doing this program in the midst of the child kidnappings and disappearances all over the country, which horrify the nation when you hear that a child has disappeared. But in a number of cases here, I mean, in the case, for example, of the Pena family, I actually called ACS. We tried over the last 2 days to get them on, and they said they couldn't come on, that the proper people were not available. But when we asked where Joseph was, who is the second child who is not adopted, since the family said that in a closed family court last year, both ACS and St. Dominic's home, the home where that was responsible for him, so they didn't know where he was. When we asked them, they looked up his case number. He said, "Well, yeah, he's in a rehabilitative residential facility." When I talked to Lucy Pena last night, his mother, he said, "But they didn't tell us that." Well, they say that their rights, their biological, their parental rights, have been severed. Hank Ornstein, what about this? And are there kids that are lost that we just don't know about?
Well, it's a very troubling system and very troubling situation. And I'll also comment on Mr. Gonzalez's question about the reform plans. The Administration for Children's Services under Giuliani and now continuing under Mayor Michael Bloomberg, you know, has tried to make some changes to increase accountability. They've raised the salaries for the ACS caseworkers, trying to improve working conditions, lowering caseloads. What's been acknowledged even this year, since Commissioner William Bell has taken over for Commissioner Scapetta, is that there's still a long ways to go to make real changes on the front lines, to make real differences in the lives of children and families involved in the system. And that is the single biggest challenge. Is there poor casework practice? Yes. Are there examples of success stories? Yes. What we need to do is build upon some of the positive things and work to correct the system. In our experience of our office helping families since 1995, we see, you know, many examples of really deficient casework where there's no sense of urgency to really resolve the problems that led to the children coming into care, and also to make sure that the parents are intimately involved with the process.
Another thing I noticed in terms of child welfare is that upstate, there's a big system upstate, not just with the Catholic Church, but of these nonprofits upstate that are basically housing city children and earning, as was mentioned in the documentary, substantial amounts of money. And they're always concerned about empty beds because an empty bed is no income for this so-called nonprofit.
Yeah. Well,
they're paid on a per diem, so basically, if they have 100 kids, for instance, and they were to send 10 kids home, they've effectively cut their budget by 10%, and that's not the American way. So it's not operating in the best interest of the child necessarily. In many cases, it's operating in the best interest of the agency, trying to stay afloat. That needs to be changed, and that's got something to do with the Adoptions and Safe Family Act, which is not all it's meant to be. It's good on paper, but in actuality, it's having a devastating effect on families.
And what about these agencies? You have a series of them in New York. Is it like the rest of the country? I mean, is this the privatization of foster care? Who is responsible when, in this case, St. Dominic's, when we asked them to come on, they wouldn't, and ACS both said, according to the family, in family court, they didn't know where this child was. This was a year ago.
Well, they were both responsible. The fact of the matter is they're close to 50 private nonprofit agencies that have contracts with the City of New York through Administration for Children's Services to deliver not just foster care, but preventive services. And the fact that we do have preventive services lies the hope that hopefully we can move towards shift some of those resources that are currently invested in foster care into community services to prevent unnecessary foster care placements. There are other places around other cities and states that have been doing that, and New York City actually is trying to do that, but there's still a long way to go.
Woody Henderson, what are you doing with your film, A Struggle for Justice? This is really its national premiere. We just played an excerpt of it.
Well, the idea, the Child Welfare Fund gave the grant to get this done. And the idea is to try to inform and educate the general public, legislators, of the negative impact of the child welfare system on children, especially in families of color and poor people in general. 75% of the children in foster care in New York are what they call low-risk cases, so there may be other ways to do it. Hank just mentioned about the preventive services. Only around 10 to 13% of that $2.1 billion budget is dedicated toward preventive services. And as that old saying is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We can save these families if we get them back home, cut budgets. Hundreds of millions of dollars can be saved by reunification and rehabilitation of these children and families as opposed to warehousing them.
If people want to get a hold of your film, where can they call or go on the web?
They can go on the web at ajuststruggle.com, or they can contact me at 212-222-7490.
That's 212-222-7490. And finally, Hank Orenstein, director of the Child Welfare Project and social worker with the New York City Public Advocates Office. This issue of the family court, it sounds to me, when I hear about these families going into the court, it's like a military tribunal. The regular rules of a court and of law don't seem to apply in terms of evidence presented. Someone can call in hearsay and say someone is abusing someone, and before you know it, a child is taken away, though children certainly have to be taken out of abusive situations.
Yeah, our office did a report in the year 2000 called Justice Denied, which was about the failed system and the crisis in family court, particularly as it relates to parents with children in foster care. And clearly, they need better legal representation. There needs to be more checks and balances and a process that is less criminalizing and more in lines of a public health model where that's more rehabilitative. And we know that such a system can work because it has been tried elsewhere.
Is it true that the rules of a regular court do not apply in family court, that families don't have to see evidence, no, even in terms of having representation?
Well, we feel that if parents had good lawyers with good working conditions and resources, they could challenge challenge the case that's being put on and really do justice and help families get their children back sooner and make sure that they get the services that they need. Because as indicated in the film, the family acknowledged that they need help. They acknowledged they had a drug problem, and there are many, many families like that do need help.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Hank Orenstein of the New York City Public Advocates Office. And also, I want to thank Sharon Salam, who has brought this issue to our attention in the New York area of People United for Children, and Bernard White at Pacifica Station WBAI, who has long focused on this issue. We will certainly continue to follow it. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Michael Franti.
I want to thank you for the seeds you've planted in me. I want to thank you for the earth that roots my feet. I say, I want to thank you for the sun that greens my leaves. I say, I want to thank you for the mystery, but it seems to me that I'm about to be feeling free now. Bye, take a bow when you feel like a superstar. Ba-da-bye, bye, shake your pants when you show what you feel inside your heart. Throw your hands in the air when you feel like love is your need, yes. When you can't feel a thing, just hold on to me, cause it seems to me that I'm about to be feeling free now.
Michael Franti, feeling free. And it's hard to believe he's right here, but he is. For nearly a decade, hip-hop artist and activist Michael Franti has been a leading progressive voice in music. He grew out of the Bay Area music and political scene of the early 90s. In 1986, he founded the drum and bass duo The Beatniks, paving the way for his next musical endeavor, The Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopracy. His most recent musical project is the musical collective Spearhead, begun in 1994. Michael's distinctive style is infused with hip-hop, soul, and jazz influences, and driven by his eloquent political lyrics. He's always used music to push social boundaries, speaks out against sexual violence, encourages his community to prevent the spread of HIV, sings about the hypocrisy of the U.S. government. His latest album is Stay Human and proposes that grassroots community activists infiltrate, overthrow, and take the media into their own hands to get important political messages out to a wider audience and takes on the politics and racism of the death penalty. Michael is in the middle of a major national tour where he is playing to crowds of thousands, actually tens of thousands, just came from Massachusetts, headed to Connecticut. What people may not know about Michael Franti, as we talk about foster care and now adoption and race today, is that Michael was also adopted, born to a white mother, black father, adopted by a white family. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk a little about that?
Well,
as you listen to the program,
yeah,
today.
I mean, I was really moved by the program because that's kind of the story of my life. I mean, I didn't have that family struggle of me being, you know, my family trying to re-find me, but as an individual, I had to go out and search out my birth parents, and it took me 2 years of trying to go through the courts, going through county birth records and marriage records and tax records.
How old were you?
I was 22. I started when I was 20, and I finished when I was 22, and then I finally found my birth mother and father. And then that whole process of not knowing your birth parents and not knowing your family history and then trying to re-establish those bonds that were there only from birth, it's kind of, people ask me what it's like, and I say it's like a death going through a mourning process, except that when you've gone through it, the person is, you know, is still there, but you go through the same tears and anger and sadness and wondering, questioning.
And what was the reaction of your birth parents when you finally located them?
Well, I saw my birth mother yesterday up in Massachusetts, and it's probably, you know, I've only seen her probably 10 times my whole life because we live on different sides of the country. But, you know, she was very happy to see me and to meet me, and since that time, it's an ongoing process of getting to know somebody, and there's a lot of you know, emotions that surround, you know, children and parents, and then wondering why. And the reason that I was given up for adoption is that my mother felt she would never have a chance with me entering into her family, which is a very racist family, coming out of the box. And she thought they would never accept me. And since her and my father never got married, she thought it was best to give me up for adoption.
And what did your father think? Your biological father.
Well, he had children of his own with another relationship, and wasn't really ready to move from. My mother was on the West Coast at the time, wasn't ready to move out, and you know, he's pretty insular, you know, emotionally. So I don't really know what he's felt. I've never really had that opportunity to you know, get to know him on that level.
So then you were adopted by a white family.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work? Were you given to an agency?
Yeah, I went through an agency, and they adopted me, and they also adopted another black child. They had three kids of their own before that. And, you know, I love my parents dearly. They did the best that they could with what they had, you know. My father was also an alcoholic. My adoptive father, so that complicated things quite a bit. But there's you know, I'm somebody who's grown up with, you know, the issue of should white parents adopt black kids? And it happens a lot. And I don't know if it's ever happened the other way, you know.
Yes, there was a famous, not well-known, but in American history back in 1904. It was called the Arizona adoption crisis, where a bunch of orphans, Irish orphans from New York, were shipped out by the Catholic Church to a Catholic parish in Arizona. And it was basically Mexican families that had agreed to adopt these orphans. And a huge battle arose in the town because the whites in the town refused to have their these Irish kids being adopted by Mexicans, and took the kids away from the families at gunpoint. And it was a huge battle that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court over whether the Catholic Church had been responsible by having these kids adopted by Mexican Catholic parents in Arizona.
And what did the court rule?
The court ruled in favor of the white vigilantes and ordered the children returned.
You have to do a song about this.
So there's an excellent book actually that's been written recently about the whole incident. I think it's almost like a Latino amistad, you know, because the Mexican parents went all the way to the Supreme Court and lost the case over their right to adopt these children.
Yeah. You know. I think that there's no replacement for love, and there's nobody who says that you can't love somebody who is of a different ethnic background. But I think that one thing that's important is culture, and you can't teach culture, you can't pay for culture, you can only experience culture. And I think that it's important for whoever is raising a child for that child to have the opportunity to experience their cultural roots and their cultural heritage. And, some families are able to do that better than others. And so many political issues surrounding it. But the bottom line is, you know, kids need to be loved, kids need to be cared for, and kids need to have an opportunity to experience their culture and their roots. And I just encourage parents who are in those situations to do the best they can and be open as much as they can to allowing their children to experience things that maybe they didn't experience himself.
Did you feel a part of your family, your adopted family?
Not, I have later in life, as I've healed, but as a youth growing up, I didn't feel part of my family. I didn't feel part of the community that I grew up in, and it was really hard. And I think it's part of what led me to be a musician. It's part of what led me to make the music that I do, is that I always felt left out. I always felt like the underdog, and I've always wanted to raise my voice for people who have felt that way. That's what my music has been about.
Can you talk about any of your songs inspired specifically? I mean, even in the lyrics.
I wrote a song in 1991. It was called Sociogenetic Experiment. And it said, sometimes I feel like a sociogenetic experiment, but
you want to play it?
I don't remember it at all, and I didn't write it on guitar, but basically the gist of it was that sometimes I feel like I've been part of this experiment of different cultural backgrounds and race and family all being put into one thing. And And because of that, I've had to really do my own, search for, artistically and spiritually and emotionally for, culture and for family, And now as a parent, I really understand the importance of just of being present for your kids,
The right wing in America always talks so much about family values, and yet in so many ways then end up supporting policies that trample on family. In terms of the progressive movement in America and the left, what do you think has been some of the failings within that movement in terms of dealing with some of these really basic issues of social problems within the family and society's need to find ways to solve some of these problems and to move families forward?
Well, I think you saw it in the documentary, that you know, families are emotional, organic beings. And the system is about numbers and bureaucracy and politics. And the two often don't, they can't take care of each other, you know. And there needs to be a more human approach to you know, the problems of families. And it's not the same for every family. It's different for every individual. And love is the one, you know, commodity that you can't spend to achieve, you know. And that's what we're trying to do, is, you know, solve these things with money and policies. And what we really need is love, and parents need to be able to have the opportunity to have stable environments so that they can love the best they can. They don't have to constantly be worrying about when their next paycheck is coming or what's happening down the street. You know, they need to be able to have that stability.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to wrap up this discussion early so you get to play Bomb the World. People mm-hmm. not only concerned about their paychecks and feeding their families, but what's going to happen to the world. And it's your message as you travel around the country. So let me give credit to the people who produce this program as Michael stands up at the mic. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Miranda Kennedy and Michael Yeh. Anthony Reparations Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at mail at www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Michael Franti, Bomb the World.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. Whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. But God bless the children who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find the solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And I say, power to the peaceful, and I sing love to the people, y'all. I sing power to the peaceful, and I sing love to the people, y'all. We may even find the solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world into pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Say we can chase down all our enemies. We can even bring them to their knees. Yes, we can bomb the world into pieces. But we can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Franti, Bomb the World. Again, for a copy of today's program, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230.